the League of Women Voters of Texas Nonpartisan Voters Guide for 2020. This 2.5-hour program can be heard Saturday at 1 p.m., Sunday at 9 a.m., Monday at 6 a.m., Tuesday at 6 p.m., and Wednesday at 3 a.m. The Voters Guide is funded and published by the League of Women Voters of Texas. The League never supports or opposes political candidates or political parties.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Friday, October 16th, 2020. I'm Michael. Here are some of the things that we'll be reading this afternoon. 32 U.S. states show upward trend in COVID-19 as country approaches 8 million cases. El Paso reports new record high of COVID cases. Doctors search for treatments for COVID-19 long haulers with few guides. Defense Department study finds low risk of coronavirus infection through air on a packed airline flight. Trump's Medicare drug discount cards face uncertain path. With coronavirus largely killing movie theaters, Disney places greater emphasis on streaming. And retail sales rose in September as people kept shopping. We'll also read an article from the Texas Tribune about how coronavirus hospitalizations are up in Texas and some fear the state is heading toward another surge. And then we'll bring you some pre-recorded reports today that are related to the vaccines, that are related to treatments, and that are related to contact tracing. Those are all be coming up right now. Let's take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 5,556. Ector County negative, 24,682. Out of 30,585 tested, with 347 pending. 106 deaths. Recovered, 4,607. Active, 843. ECISD daily cases, 6 students, 4 staff. Midland County, 4,347 confirmed, 87 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased in Texas by 670 compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 15th, 4,615 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 707 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 15th, 4,263 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths stayed the same compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 15th, 95 new deaths were reported. And West Texas Intermediate is trading at $40.54, down 42 cents. Now we'll look at coronavirus briefs. The antiviral drug remdesivir does not appear to have a beneficial impact on coronavirus patients' chances of survival, according to a study sponsored by the World Health Organization. Hospitals are bursting at the seams as virus rages across Midwest. The president of the State University of New York, SUNY, at Oneota, where more than 700 students tested positive for the coronavirus, has resigned, officials announced Thursday. New COVID-19 cases in Europe are rising nearly 42% higher than in the U.S. Indianapolis Colts shut down practice facility after positive tests. Now, here are some short articles. 32 U.S. states show upward trend in COVID-19 as country approaches 8 million cases, from CNN's Amanda Watts and Christina Maxouris. The U.S. is nearing 8 million COVID-19 cases and averaging more than 50,000 daily new infections, a sign the country is in for a tough winter, experts say. Yesterday, the U.S. topped 60,000 new cases in a single day for the first time since August 14th. More than 217,000 have died so far in the U.S. due to the virus. Here's what the data shows. At least 32 states are showing an upward trend in new cases compared to the previous week, according to Johns Hopkins. 15 states are showing steady trends. Only 3 states are showing a downward trend: Louisiana, Kentucky, and Vermont. An updated forecast from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation now projects the U.S. could top 389,000 COVID-19 deaths by February 1st. And the latest ensemble forecast, published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, shows more than 20,000 Americans could die from the virus in just the next 3 weeks. El Paso reports new record high of COVID cases, from CNN's Kay Jones. The city of El Paso is reporting a new record high daily number of COVID-19 cases, just a day after setting the record for single-day cases. El Paso reported 838 new cases Friday. The day before, they had set a daily record with 717 new cases. There are now 7,399 active cases in the city, according to the city's public health department. So far, there have been no new deaths reported Friday. The city reported 423 hospitalizations as a result of COVID-19, with 112 people in the intensive care unit. On Thursday, the Texas Department of State Health Services said only 8 ICU beds were available in Region 1, which includes El Paso. Doctors search for treatments for COVID-19 long haulers with few guides, by the Washington Post's Lenny Bernstein. COVID-19 took its best shot at Edison Chalusa in May, sending him to intensive care. But the disease is still not done with him. For the past 4 months, long after his release from the hospital, Chalusa has been racked by lingering ailments, paralyzing fatigue, shortness of breath, a stutter he never had before. The disease, it wears on you, body, mind, and spirit, Chalusa, a 51-year-old hospital worker, said recently. You can be fine all day, and then all of a sudden, your body just shuts down. No explanation, no reason. It just shuts down. But unlike some long haulers in the early part of the pandemic who struggled to persuade anyone that symptoms of COVID-19 could last for months, Chalusa is being attended by a team of specialists. Long haulers are in every country and every language, said Igor J. Korolink, who started a program for COVID-19 neurocognitive problems at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, one of the numerous post-COVID-19 clinics opening around the country. It's going to be a big problem. It's not going to go away. Defense Department study finds low risk of coronavirus infection through air on a packed airline flight, by Ian Duncan, Washington Post. A Defense Department study of the risk of catching the coronavirus on a packed commercial flight concluded that a person would have to sit next to an infectious passenger for at least 54 hours to receive a dangerous dose of the virus through the air. Researchers concluded, assuming that passengers wear surgical masks continuously, very little of the virus spreads because of how the air is circulated and filtered on the planes. The study, which used a mannequin expelling simulated virus particles to determine how the virus spreads as an aerosol inside an aircraft cabin, had some limitations, but it offers a new way to try to understand the risks of flying during the pandemic. Trump's Medicare drug discount cards face uncertain path, by Amy Goldstein. 3 weeks after President Trump announced the government would send tens of millions of older Americans $200 to help pay for medicine, the election season idea is mired in uncertainty over whether such drug discount cards are legal, proper, or will ever exist. Since the last-minute inclusion of the cards in a presidential speech, Trump's aides and Medicare officials have been hastily drafting and revising a proposal to build scaffolding under the president's promise. This account of those efforts draws on interviews and information from 5 individuals familiar with the work, all of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity to disclose internal matters. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar and Seema Verma, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, are distancing themselves from the idea, each emphasizing that they were not consulted by the White House before the president's announcement, said three officials familiar with their thinking. Still, Verma has been involved in the plan's development, officials said. With coronavirus largely killing movie theaters, Disney places greater emphasis on streaming, by the Washington Post's Stephen Zajcik. As uncertainty over the coronavirus continued and consumers' transition to digital accelerates, Disney on Monday reorganized its corporate divisions to bolster the power of streaming service Disney+. Announced to much fanfare by the company, the realignment removed marketing and distribution responsibilities from Disney's film studio and TV operations and transferred them to a newly created digital unit that includes Disney+, as well as Hulu and ESPN+. The heads of each group will report to Disney's chief executive, Bob Chapek. Managing content creation distinct from distribution will allow us to be more effective and nimble in making the content consumers want most, delivered in the way they prefer to consume it, Chapek said in a company statement announcing the change. Our creative teams will concentrate on what they do best, making world-class franchise-based content. Retail sales rose in September as people kept shopping. From CNN's Nathaniel Meyerson. Retail sales climbed in September for the fifth straight month as people spent on clothing, sporting goods, furniture, and other items in stores and online. U.S. retail sales rose 1.9% in September, the Commerce Department reported Friday. That's well above the 0.7% rise predicted by economists surveyed by Refinitiv. In August, retail sales grew 0.6%. Retail sales had slumped to a seven-year low in April as coronavirus prompted stores across the country to shut their doors, though sales bounced back to pre-pandemic levels in July. Economists and retail analysts say consumers have shifted their spending away from travel and leisure and to areas such as home improvement and electronics. Sales at clothing and clothing accessory stores grew 11% in September from the month prior, while sales at sporting goods, hobby, musical equipment, and bookstores jumped 5.7%. From the Texas Standard, coronavirus hospitalizations are up in Texas as some fear the state is headed toward another surge. Hospitals in some parts of the state are filling with coronavirus patients, alarming health officials who say Texas could be on the brink of another surge after a relative plateau in September. The number of hospitalized coronavirus patients has swung upward in parts of the state, including West Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Panhandle, and El Paso, where hospitalizations have reached an all-time high and the mayor warned of an unprecedented number of new cases. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins this week upped the area's coronavirus threat level to red, the highest risk, as more patients are being admitted to hospitals with COVID-19 and as infections have climbed, including among school-aged children. Unfortunately, we are currently going in the wrong direction, Jenkins said. Experts blame social events like birthday parties and game day gatherings for the recent upticks, and they say there is widespread fatigue for following the stringent guidelines to wear masks, practice social distancing, and avoid crowded indoor spaces. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cited small family gatherings as an increasing threat this week. A wave of infections and hospitalizations swept Texas this summer, overwhelming hospitals along the U.S.-Mexico border. Officials worry another flare-up could loom just as Texans prepare to celebrate the holidays. Lubbock has more COVID-19 hospitalizations than it's ever had, and at least one hospital is full. In Lubbock, home to Texas Tech University and Lubbock Christian University, health officials say the increase in hospitalization of mostly older residents has lagged a few weeks behind when they saw an uptick in infections among teenagers and young adults. That mirrors what happened earlier this summer when there was a spike in cases associated with bars reopening, said Catherine Wells, the city's director of public health. Dr. Ron Cook, the City of Lubbock's health authority and a professor at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center, said people are tired of being cooped up and less fearful of the virus than they might have been in its early months. There's been an increasingly lackadaisical approach to safety precautions. There are people who refuse to wear masks, and he thinks some assume we're 3/4 of the way over this because businesses can open at 75% capacity. Health experts say wearing a mask can help prevent the spread of a virus. Not to have a Game of Thrones theme, but winter is coming, he said, evoking a well-known line from the television show. I'm concerned about that because it pushes people indoors, and then our spread is worse. Now let's go to some pre-recorded reports. Since I've been reading quite a few longer articles this week, we haven't had time for some of these reports. And honestly, they're starting to stack up on me, and I'd like to get as many in as possible. So I'm just going to roll several reports in a row. This first set of reports concentrates on vaccines. The first is the latest developments on COVID-19 treatments and vaccines. The next is Pfizer seems to lead coronavirus vaccine development race. How did they get ahead? The third report is facing many unknowns, states rush to plan distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. And then, how Operation Warp Speed's big vaccine contracts could stay secret. Finally, the fifth report is whistleblower on how political pressure affects the safety of coronavirus vaccine. Here's the first of those five reports.
Coronavirus is on the rise again in this country. The seven-day average of new cases hit record highs in 20 states. This happened since Saturday. It comes as two coronavirus studies have been put on pause by drug makers as they investigate safety concerns. One of them is a clinical trial similar to the experimental COVID-19 antibody treatment President Trump received. It makes it clear how little we actually know about these treatments. NPR's Allison Aubrey is with us now to talk through developments on COVID-19 treatments and vaccines. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, Rachel.
So this week, both a vaccine trial and a trial of a new therapy to treat COVID have been put on pause. I mean, it sounds worrisome. Is it worrisome?
You know, it's really not unusual to put a trial on hold or pause, and that's what has happened with the clinical trial of a Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine. I should note that Johnson & Johnson is a sponsor of NPR. During the trial, a study volunteer developed an unexplained illness that is now under investigation. I spoke to LJ Tan, a scientist with the Immunization Action Coalition, about this. He says when there are thousands of people in a clinical trial, there will be illnesses. They may or may not be related to the vaccine. That's the point of pausing the trial until more is learned.
They're doing exactly what they need to do. They're doing exactly what's typically done. Investigate that one reaction and make sure that it really does have nothing to do with the vaccine.
Now, there's another COVID vaccine trial on hold as well, the AstraZeneca trial that happened back in September after a second participant was diagnosed with a neurological condition. So this could slow down the process, but it won't derail it.
Okay. Eli Lilly's clinical trial has also had some problems. What can you tell us about that trial and why they put it on pause?
Sure. Well, it's a trial of an experimental antibody treatment that, as you said, is similar to the one President Trump received and has been touting. This has also been paused due to a potential safety concern. This is under investigation. The company that makes the drug, Eli Lilly, said it supports this decision by an independent safety monitoring board. Again, it isn't out of the ordinary, but there's also a report from Reuters that FDA inspectors found quality control problems at an Eli Lilly plant after an inspection last year. Now that plant is ramping up to produce the antibody therapy. In a statement, an Eli Lilly spokesperson told me the company had received a notice from the FDA after the inspection. It included two findings related to control of what they say are electronic systems in the plant. The company says these findings do not impact product quality or patient safety, but the FDA will likely want resolution of these issues before granting emergency use authorization.
So until now, Allison, kids have not been included in these COVID-19 vaccine trials. But I understand that's about to change. The Food and Drug Administration has given permission to this one pharmaceutical company to get kids as young as 12 years old in its vaccine trial, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's become increasingly clear that children get the virus, and though they often have mild cases or they're asymptomatic, they can infect other people, especially older kids. So infectious disease experts say the best way to determine if children should get a COVID vaccine is to actually include them in the trials. Currently, about half the participants in this Pfizer vaccine trial, that's the company that made this announcement, are in their mid-50s to mid-80s. That's understandable, given that older people are at higher risk of serious illness. But LJ Tan of the Immunization Action Coalition told me it's significant that Pfizer will expand its trial to include kids 12 and up.
So I think this is a really big deal, because without clinical trials actually done in children, the only way to actually extend the use of the COVID-19 vaccine into children would be to rely on the adult data. And that's not the best way to approach providing a new vaccine for a child.
He says he'd like to see some of the other companies testing COVID vaccines include children, too.
I mean, that just seems to me, even as a parent, it raises flags, like putting kids in clinical trials. What's the reaction to this? Have pediatricians weighed in?
Yeah, I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics says it's important for children to be in the trials because children could respond differently to the vaccine as long as it's done safely and effectively. And so that's sort of where we are. There is support for this.
NPR's Allison Aubrey, thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
One company appears to lead the pack for getting a green light for its COVID-19 vaccine, Pfizer. The company's CEO has hinted that preliminary results from its vaccine trial could be available as soon as the end of this month. NPR's Joe Palca looks at how the Pfizer vaccine made it to the front of the line.
The race to find a vaccine for COVID-19 started in mid-January. That's when Chinese scientists published the genetic sequence of the coronavirus causing the disease. At the time, no one even knew if it was possible to make a vaccine against this new viral invader. When I spoke to Pfizer's chief scientific officer for viral vaccines at the start of May this year, he was sounding confident.
I think there's a very good chance we'll have a vaccine.
Phil Dormitzer says Pfizer's advantage came from a strategic partnership it made with the German biotech company BioNTech. The two companies had been working on a flu vaccine using a new kind of technology based on the virus's genes. Dormitzer says BioNTech was able to quickly refocus its research from flu to the coronavirus.
It's literally a matter of swapping out its one gene and swapping in a SARS coronavirus spike gene.
The SARS coronavirus spike gene is the key to making a COVID-19 vaccine. Dormitzer says BioNTech quickly came up with vaccine candidates.
And then what requires a much greater resource and infrastructure, we can come in and really start to pitch in there.
Pfizer organized initial safety testing of several different versions of the vaccine in May.
We started with four different agents at three different doses each.
Kirsten Leich is one of the scientists who tested the Pfizer vaccine candidates. She's at the University of Maryland Center for Vaccine Development. She says normally testing all those different versions at all those different doses would have taken years, but for the COVID vaccine, they did it in 4 months.
So we're just moving very quickly.
Part of the reason they were able to finish so fast was a new technique for measuring how well a volunteer's immune system responded to the vaccine. Peiyong Shi at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston developed the technique. He found a way to tag genes in the virus so they light up when they infected cells in the lab.
You don't have to wait for 4 or 5 days. And the computer calculates the data you wish. It's just like very rapid.
By the end of July, Pfizer was ready to start large-scale testing in humans. The company has now enrolled some 44,000 volunteers in a trial to show that the vaccine can prevent disease in someone exposed to the coronavirus and isn't likely to cause any rare health problems. It's a huge logistical undertaking, but one Edward Walsh from the University of Rochester says Pfizer is quite capable of.
They've got a well-oiled system for testing vaccines at various stages of their development.
Even though other companies started large efficacy studies around the same time, University of Maryland's Kirsten Leich says it's not surprising Pfizer may get results first.
Pfizer's incredibly organized and is always like a couple steps ahead, planning where they want to go.
Developing a vaccine during a pandemic is tough. And Like says it's impossible to ignore the politics that have been swirling around the effort. President Trump has accused regulators of trying to slow down the approval process to thwart his re-election bid. But Like says politics hasn't invaded the actual research.
From boots on the ground getting these studies done, it's 100% science, and that's been super rewarding.
It's possible that Pfizer may have enough evidence that their vaccine works before the end of the month, at which point the company could go to the FDA and ask for permission to distribute it to the public. FDA has said its review could take weeks. But for his part, Pfizer's Phil Dormitzer says that's time well spent. Having an external review of the data Pfizer has collected is essential for the public to be convinced that the vaccine is safe and actually works.
I work for a pharmaceutical company, but I'm also a consumer. So I'm thinking of myself on the other end. I would want someone else to verify that as well.
And just to provide a little perspective, everything about developing a vaccine for COVID-19 is moving faster than usual, from creating the vaccine candidates, to testing them, to getting them ready for FDA's regulatory review, a review that will also likely go much faster than usual. It still may not seem fast enough to some, but for the people used to working in this field, it's been nothing short of remarkable. Joe Palca, NPR News.
We all talk a lot about when a vaccine for the coronavirus will be developed. But an equally important step, once it's developed, I mean, you got to figure out how to distribute it. Later today, U.S. states have to submit their COVID vaccine distribution plans to the Centers for Disease Control. This is to show that they have worked out how they're going to get a potential vaccine to citizens in their state. NPR's Ping Huang is with us now to talk about it. Hi, Ping.
Hi, Rachel.
So you've been talking to state health officials. I mean, do they have these distribution plans? Have they worked this out?
Yeah, in a sense. My co-reporter Selena Simmons-Duffin and I, we've been hearing from state departments all over the country, from California to Texas, North Dakota, Michigan, Virginia, Florida, and they only had 30 days to do it. So back on September 16th, the CDC gave them a playbook for vaccine distribution and said that they were to tailor it to their own states with plans for how to get the vaccines out to their people. And they've been racing to pull it together. It's been described to me as anxiety-inducing, frustrating, and also really exciting to be doing the work that will help get the vaccine out and hopefully help end this pandemic. I talked to Claire Hannon, who's head of the Association of Immunization Managers.
You know, it's really cramming 3 to 6 months worth of strategic discussions with task force, with stakeholders, into 30 days.
She says the process for many has been like herding a lot of cats. In Minnesota, Chris Ayersman is director of infectious disease at the state health department. She says the document they'll submit does address all the CDC's requirements, but it's far from final.
We've kind of described it as framing up a house. So we're going to keep adding to it, obviously, as we get more and more information. But right now, we've kind of just built a frame.
Ayersman says the information that still needs to be added are big keystones, like which vaccines will actually be approved and how many doses will be available. But even without knowing those specifics, there is a lot of problem solving that can be started now. Some of the vaccines may need to be stored in super cold temperatures, much colder than your home freezer. Molly Howell, immunization program manager for the state of North Dakota, says that's a logistical problem they're thinking through.
So the storage container that the ultra-low cold chain vaccine comes in can maintain temperatures for up to 10 days if it's unopened. If the container is opened, then you have to kind of recharge it with dry ice every so often.
North Dakota has bought some ultra-cold freezers and is trying to figure out how to get or make their own dry ice so they can get the vaccine out to people who live in rural communities. In Texas, the state is starting to get hospitals, doctor's offices, and pharmacies registered to give out the vaccine when it is available. Decrecia Limbrick, who's assistant health department director in Houston, says they're considering all the different scenarios for vaccination down to the weather. It can get really hot and humid in Houston.
If we should get those hot days, we want to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the vaccine. But also when you think about individuals potentially having to work in those conditions, just making sure that we take care of the workforce as well.
In Virginia, Christy Gray runs the immunization division at the Department of Health. She says they ran a simulation to see how their plan works in different conditions.
Let's just poke all kinds of holes in it. Let's take it for a ride and see. How can we improve it? You know, are there things we haven't thought of?
Submitting these first plans to the CDC is a milestone, But Jim Blumenstock from the Association for State and Territorial Health Officials says it's just the very beginning.
Planning is just that. It's not execution. And when the whistle blows and we start this campaign, it's going to be, you know, close to a year-long effort.
Bing, I mean, this has all got to be expensive, right? Where's the funding coming from?
Well, Blumenstock says money is the other big missing piece of these plans. And last month, CDC Director Robert Redfield told Congress that states are going to need up to $6 billion to distribute vaccines. Yesterday, Blumenstock's organization, along with the Association of Immunization Managers, formally asked Congress for $8.4 billion. So far, the money has not been approved by Congress, and it's actually not very clear when a COVID package might get through. The election and politics are really complicating things at the moment.
Right. Okay, so states are going to submit their plans. Then what happens?
Well, the National Governors Association sent a letter to the president yesterday. It was co-signed by the heads of the NGA, Democrat Andrew Cuomo from New York and Republican Asa Hutchinson from Arkansas. And it basically said, we need to talk. We really want this vaccine campaign to roll out smoothly, but it takes a lot more than just the cost of a vaccine. You know, states have to put up data systems to track who's getting it, to remind them to come back for second doses. They have to buy gloves and syringes and dispose of medical waste. They also have to hire and train a lot of temporary staff to carry out that work. So the governors have asked the president for a meeting to discuss what the federal government is doing versus states and how it will all get paid for.
So meanwhile, the U.S. is approaching the 8 million mark for the total number of known COVID cases, which is just staggering. Can you just tell us what's happening with the virus right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, new case counts are rising across much of the country, and right now, the highest risk hotspots are in parts of the West and Midwest, you know, in North Dakota and South Dakota, Montana and Wisconsin. The case numbers per capita are really soaring, and hospitals in these states are filling up. A field hospital actually opened up this week at the State Fair Park in Milwaukee to take in overflow patients, and a month ago, the U.S. was seeing about 35,000 new cases a day. Now that number has climbed to over 50,000. The CDC reportedly told governors this week that one of the reasons for this surge in cases is because of small household gatherings, you know, groups of people coming together in homes without masks.
NPR's Ping Huang, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
The Trump administration compares its crash program to develop a coronavirus vaccine to the Manhattan Project. And like the secretive atomic bomb initiative, details about Operation Warp Speed's work may take years to fully unravel. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
Operation Warp Speed has announced vaccine contracts worth billions of dollars to pharmaceutical companies. But NPR has learned that many of the deals have been issued through a non-government intermediary. This approach allows Operation Warp Speed to award the money quickly, but can weaken the oversight and transparency of traditional government contracting. A senior administration official tells NPR that the government took this approach to address the pandemic. Robin Feldman, a professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, says it makes some sense to cut through red tape during a crisis. But there's a trade-off.
We have to be on a wartime footing. We have to operate in a different way. However, we have to be careful about what we throw out in that process.
Most government contracts have to follow a set of rules called the Federal Acquisition Regulation. Franklin Turner, a lawyer who works on government contracts, says the rules include everything from an anti-human trafficking clause to requirements about ethics and company conduct.
It's really a Bible that the government and contractors are supposed to follow with respect to a given acquisition.
But the standard contracting process can take months or years. So the government allowed an alternative called an Other Transaction Agreement, or OTA. This approach was intended to attract companies that otherwise wouldn't be willing to contract with the federal government. But these alternative agreements come with a risk for the government and taxpayers. They don't include some standard protections. Typical contracts would allow the government to take control of a drug or vaccine if, for example, the drug maker engages in price gouging. Leaving that out worries people like Catherine Artizone, a lawyer at Knowledge Ecology International, a nonprofit focused on intellectual property policy.
All of the regulations that are in a traditional government contract are there to protect ordinary, everyday Americans. And it's very concerning that they're left out here.
Four vaccine contracts worth more than $6 billion went through an intermediary called Advanced Technology International. It manages a lot of these non-traditional contracts for consortia of companies, academics, and nonprofits. The Defense Department spoke with Advanced Technology International in the spring about something called the Medical CBRN Defense Consortium. Its members included pharmaceutical companies already working on COVID-19 vaccines. And the organization already had a standing contract with the government regarding this consortium. Robert Tuohy is Advanced Technology International's former chief operating officer. He said it collected vaccine proposals from consortium members and passed them along to the federal government to make a decision.
Then they hand us the money and ask us to award essentially a sub OTA to the team that they have selected within the membership of the consortium.
The Defense Department never told Tuohy's team that they were doing work for Operation Warp Speed. He called that information invisible to his organization. Because these OTAs were issued through a third party, it might be impossible to get copies of the contracts under public records laws. Artisone and I separately filed public records requests for large vaccine procurement contracts that HHS has announced. Here's Artisone again.
The stakes are as high as you could ever imagine, and now we don't know what's in the agreements.
So far, neither of us have gotten the records we asked for. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
And we're going to hear now from a pandemic whistleblower. Rick Bright was one of the federal government's top vaccine scientists as head of BARDA. That's a federal agency that develops vaccines and treatments. He was ousted from the job back in April, but he did not leave the government. He was reassigned to what he says was a lesser role at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. Rick Bright did file a whistleblower complaint, alleging politics. Bright says his work and that of other scientists was being ignored to meet political goals and advance President Trump's reelection aspirations. But Rick Bright stayed on the job until this week when he resigned from NIH and the federal government. When I spoke with him today, I asked, what was the final straw? Why leave now?
I think the why now in the last week or so was because of my demotion and reassignment. The work I was assigned, I got done. For the last 4 to 6 weeks, I've had little to do. It's become painfully clear to me that the Trump administration does not value my decades of experience in developing drugs and vaccines and diagnostics, and I cannot sit idly by and watch people die and not do something about it. It's important to go back. Since the beginning of this pandemic, the administration, our senior public health officials, who we put our trust in, to protect us and save our lives for these events, were taking reckless steps in promoting drugs that were not safe, not proven to be effective, and in fact might actually be very harmful and cause death. And when I learned that their plan and strategy was to push some of these drugs out to the streets of America and putting lives at risk, I spoke up. I stepped out of line. I broke protocol, which basically is complicity, to sit back and be quiet.
You were raising this not directly with the president, presumably, but with scientists up the chain of command who you report to, including very respected scientists in this government. Were they urging you, hey, just ignore it, let's go with the politics?
They were telling me to go with the politics. This was a directive from the White House. We had no choice. I had no choice but to get it done and get it done as quickly as possible.
President Trump tweeted, you were, quote, a disgruntled employee not liked or respected by people I spoke to, end quote. To that, Rick Bright, you say what?
Well, number one, we're hearing that far too many times from this president. So anyone who speaks up and speaks out and speaks the truth is now labeled a disgruntled employee by President Trump. So we see a really bad pattern occurring here for truth tellers who are being denigrated and criticized by the President of the United States. But my record speaks for itself. We have a really strong organization in BARDA. We have a track record of having 54 drugs and vaccines and diagnostics approved by the FDA. These are life-saving medicines at work today to protect the health of people in our nation and around the world. We were making great progress. We put a strategy in place in January before the president was willing to admit there was a problem. We implemented that strategy in early February before the president was willing to tell Americans the truth about this pandemic. So at every angle, the President of the United States gave false assurances to Americans, I was pushing our team forward as aggressively as possible. I knew it was a deadly situation on our hands. Most scientists knew it was a deadly situation on our hands. My decision was to push forward, even if it meant going against the narrative of the president.
Let me turn you to a vaccine. In your complaint, your whistleblower complaint, you write about tremendous pressure to have a vaccine ready by Election Day, which of course is now 20-something days away. It is not looking likely that deadline will be met. How do you read that? What does that mean?
That's reckless. It's absolutely reckless. The President of the United States should stay completely out of any development and process associated with developing a drug or a vaccine or a diagnostic.
What is reckless? You mean the political pressure to get a vaccine, to rush one out?
To push it too fast, to rush it ahead of the science. I can guarantee you that we have 1,000 or more really strong, experienced scientists inside government and the FDA, CDC, NIH, and BARDA working day and night, doing their best to get a vaccine and drug available as quickly as possible. We have 10
times
that many.
But the political pressure hasn't prevailed. I mean, the president didn't get his way here. It does not look like we are going to have a vaccine rolled out to Americans by Election Day.
I wouldn't trust that at this point. It would not surprise me if President Trump or Secretary Azar try to use their authority to say anything that came their way between now and the election that they would approve or give some special authorization for use or consideration for use. The scientists right now in the FDA are under a tremendous amount of pressure as they put forth the best guidelines to evaluate the safety of a vaccine. They would rather have the vaccine sooner than later, but they're not willing to compromise the safety evaluation of that vaccine that would go into healthy people to prevent disease. But they are facing name-calling, denigration, political pressure by the president, on the commissioner, on the career scientist, to break that protocol. And I tell you, they are resisting every single day, and it is demoralizing, it is distracting, it is causing potentially further delays of the vaccine because of the pressure and the limelight the president is putting on those hardworking scientists.
How is it causing further delays? Because so much time and energy is being caught up in the politics here? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. It's very frustrating. It's very demoralizing. It's very distracting. And the more pressure that they're put on to move faster, to do things at the whim or the directive of the president of the United States, and especially if the FDA commissioner is allowing that pressure to sink down into the ranks of the career scientists, it is just nerve-wracking. It is distracting. That added pressure could lead to mistakes, could lead to someone making an error when they should be focusing on reviewing data every day.
As someone who has had a front row seat to government efforts to develop a vaccine, how confident are you that when one is released to the American people, it will be safe, that we should take it?
Now, what encourages me is the number of different approaches being used today to make a vaccine. It's unprecedented in every way. And I actually work very closely with many of those companies and their senior leadership and the scientists making those vaccines. I have a lot of confidence that they're doing the best they can in looking at every factor. And I know the scientists and the government are doing the same. I have confidence that they will rise up, they will speak out against their own career and against everything that could happen to them. They're going to do their best to prevent the president and political pressures to do something that's going to cause harm to Americans.
Rick Bright, thank you.
Thank you.
That is vaccine research scientist Rick Bright, who has now left his leadership roles in the federal government.
Now we're going to move to treatments. Here's a story from NPR. Web of wellness doctors promote injections of unproven coronavirus treatment.
And now a look at the coronavirus pandemic and how some people are allegedly trying to profit off of people's fears. An NPR investigation has revealed a web of doctors in the wellness industry marketing an unproven drug for COVID-19. The Food and Drug Administration has never approved the drug for any condition. And as NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports, there are now calls for the agency to investigate.
The drug is called Thymosin Alpha-1, and there are three steps to it reaching consumers. First, labs known as compounding pharmacies supply and promote the drug. Next, doctors in the wellness industry market the drug on social media and prescribe it to patients. And finally, the federal government fails to deter many false and misleading health claims. Let's start with the compounding pharmacies. In March, a man named Ryan Smith gave a video presentation to doctors on drugs they could give their patients for COVID-19.
We're not thinking this is going to be a super deadly virus. But with that being said, obviously we want to talk about it and some of the things we can do to help with prevention. I mean, something you can do to sort of market to your patients.
Smith is a vice president of the company TaylorMade Compounding. It's a compounding pharmacy. Don't think like CVS or Walgreens. It's a facility that can legally make customized drugs for patients. In his presentation, Smith falsely claimed that thymosin alpha-1 was FDA-approved and said that regular injections could help patients with everything from Lyme disease to anti-aging to COVID-19.
Because it has such positive effects, no negative effects, and if they can only afford one product, this would be the one for both prophylaxis and treatment.
The FDA says there is no reliable scientific evidence that the drug should be used for COVID-19. So that's compounding pharmacies. Next step, the doctors who amplified these messages on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
This is a very powerful prescription-grade protein called thymosin alpha-1.
It will help boost your immune system.
To seek out and kill viruses like COVID-19.
We found more than 30 doctors in Tennessee, Texas, Florida, California, and several other states promoting the drug. A doctor who developed a supplement for Gwyneth Paltrow's brand Goop sold it. Injections cost up to $400 for a 10-syringe set, all out of pocket. It's unclear how many patients may have been prescribed the drug, and we've not yet found evidence that people have been harmed by the drug, but there's reason to worry. In general, drugs from compounding pharmacies are not as strictly regulated. Here's former FDA official Julie Dome.
They're subject to a lower quality standard, and so it's very important that they really only be used when medically necessary.
In the past, the FDA warned TaylorMade Compounding that problems in its labs put patients' health at risk. And Ryan Smith, the man who led the company's presentation, was previously convicted of criminal voyeurism after dropping out of the University of Kentucky Medical School in 2015.
Police accuse a former UK student, listen to this, of putting cameras in some women's restrooms on campus.
Kentucky State Police records say Smith is now a registered sex offender and that a victim was 16 years old. Smith and TaylorMade Compounding did not respond to requests for comment. The Trump administration has said it has taken unprecedented action to stop misleading advertising about purported COVID cures, with lawsuits and even criminal charges. But those efforts clearly did not deter claims about thymosin alpha-1, says Bonnie Patton of the group Truth in Advertising.
Given the limited resources, they've done about the best they can, but it's definitely not enough to stop the multitude of scams and schemes that are out there.
The FDA has been slow to act, according to Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy. He's an Illinois Democrat who's led investigations into alleged COVID scams.
Junk products and bad actors take advantage of the situation, and then only later on does the Trump administration get into the action, but oftentimes it's too late, and a lot of the damage has been done.
The FDA declined to answer our questions, but Krishnamurthy said the agency should begin an investigation into the people selling thymosin alpha-1 to find out if anyone has actually gotten hurt. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Now we've gone over vaccines and we've gone over treatments. Let's go to the third leg in the stool, and that is contact tracing. In this NPR report, we hear that COVID-19 contact tracing's workforce is barely inching up, even as cases are surging.
We have an update now on contact tracing in the United States. At the start of the pandemic, we were told that contact tracing was vital to contain it. Health officials needed to identify who was in contact with an infected person and get them to isolate themselves. Earlier this year, NPR revealed how few contact tracers states were hiring. Now the update comes via the latest exclusive contact tracing survey by NPR in collaboration with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has the results.
Our survey found that the United States has more than 50,000 contact tracers for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic hit. That's an increase from the last survey, which found around 40,000 contact tracers, but
it feels stagnant.
That's Crystal Watson, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, who oversaw this survey.
I don't see a lot of evidence that we have a new push or renewed interest in trying to get us there to prepare for what we might see this winter.
Public health experts think the country is likely to see new surges as the weather gets colder. And contact tracing is the kind of program that's hard to scale up quickly when transmission starts escalating out of control.
We're already seeing cases tick up across the U.S. and in Europe, and it is concerning.
Currently, case numbers are climbing in North and South Dakota, Montana, and Wisconsin, which was one of many states that indicated it's planning to hire more contact tracers. Elizabeth Goodsit from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services wrote in response to the survey that they are, quote, maximizing limited resources in attending to the surge in number as well as the increased complexity of cases. Another state, Minnesota, responded that it had the resources to run its program for now, Watson says, but added,
there are questions related to sustainability and ongoing funding.
There has yet to be significant federal investment in contact tracing, despite some proposals in Congress. That lack of investment has meant the country's efforts fall far short of the workforces deployed to contact trace in some East Asian countries, says Danielle Allen. She directs the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University, and early in the pandemic, she was part of a group that advocated for 300,000 contact tracers nationwide.
We just, as a country, we have not been able to transition in that kind of rapid way to build out on that scale.
Our survey shows instead the country continues to inch up its contact tracing workforce while financial resources are stretched to the limit. Going forward, we'll likely keep inching up, she says. Allen and other experts note that contact tracing isn't a silver bullet. When transmission is high, it becomes much more difficult for the process to keep the spread of the virus in check. But it's still valuable, she says, in part because of the data that can come from tracking how the virus is spreading through a community.
If you can work out that you have a whole cluster coming from one specific kind of activity, well, then you know, like, that's what you shut down. You don't have to shut down everything.
In our survey, the vast majority of states say they're gathering this data, but fewer than half are making the data public on a government website. Watson of Johns Hopkins hopes that more states will follow suit so that data from contact tracing can be used not just for allocating resources and informing policy decisions, but for helping regular people make decisions about their lives, like whether to go to a restaurant or the gym, or whether it's safe to send kids back to school. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
And in our final pre-recorded report today from the Texas Standard, we have a report about an interesting phenomena that is going on with everything that has been happening this year. Texas lottery scratch-off sales have soared in 2020. Here's more.
As you probably know, the coronavirus pandemic has been a net negative for the U.S. economy as a whole. But here and there, you'll find sales are up. One apparent boom, scratch-off tickets. The San Antonio Express News reports sales of scratch-off tickets were up 14% over the last fiscal year, and that helped the Texas Lottery, which helps fund schools and veteran services, have its biggest sales year ever. So what's behind the big jump in people playing the odds? Let's ask Devin Mills. He's an assistant professor of community, family, and addiction sciences at Texas Tech University. Professor Mills, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I think some listeners might be surprised to hear about record lottery sales at a time when the economy is struggling so much. Does it surprise you, Professor Mills?
No, this is actually very common. We saw the same thing in a variety of different countries, not just the United States, but in Iceland, across Europe. I'm not familiar with any research in Asia at the moment, but we saw a variety of different cases in the 2008 recession where individuals were turning to the lottery. And the first thing I want to make clear is that gambling is a recreational activity. And so there's a variety of different motivations that might explain why individuals are turning to any sort of gambling, whether it be lottery tickets or something else. When it comes to lottery tickets in particular, it could be some of the common motivations. There's a socialization piece. There's been some research to suggest that the more your social network is encouraging and engaging in lottery tickets and sharing in that moment, talking about the jackpots, that might explain your increased liking to engage in the lottery and play the lottery. There's also the idea of coping, that idea of just, or the enhancement, rush, the escapism piece that might be explaining it. And these don't necessarily even address the obvious one, the idea of money, the idea of winning, the idea of being a big winner. is very much a salient part of the advertising campaign in all state lotteries, not just Texas.
I see. When you put it that way, I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking of this about an, from an economic perspective, but not just in the light of, you know, economic trouble, but in light of the particular challenges of a pandemic and the isolation. Does that connect dots for you?
It does a little bit. Now, in psychology, we try to take an individual focus. Of course, we often use averages across large groups, and so we don't always focus on the individual, and sometimes that can get lost. But when we think about individuals' perspective on their own economic situation, this has been referred to in the literature as personal reflective deprivation. And Michael Cowan in the UK has done some really interesting studies in this area and linking it to gambling behaviors. So this idea, this personal relative deprivation, it refers to this feeling of resentment or dissatisfaction with regards to a desired or a feeling of deserving outcomes relative to others. And so the idea that I don't have enough money and I should. Of course, this corresponds to other personality traits that we could go and spend a long time discussing, but this could be explaining some of the issues, and especially during financial hardships when individuals lose their jobs in a manner that is of no control of their own, they may be feeling a bit miffed about that. They may be feeling a desire to change that immediately. This, of course, doesn't even take into account the various strains. If you are a head of a household and how much strain losing your job plays a role on there. And so a lot of indirect effects are coming in there to increase that perception. So when we look at the psychology of economics, we tend to look at individuals' perception of where they think they are relative to everyone else.
Stepping back a little bit, when you hear stories about, you know, lottery ticket sales, scratch-off ticket sales in particular going up, does it set off any alarms for you from a public health perspective?
One thing that we have found, and this is true in across a number of studies that I mentioned earlier with regards to looking at the effect of the 2008 recession on lottery sales, is that while lottery sales did go up in a variety of different countries, including the United States, there wasn't evidence of an increase of problem gambling. I should say there's an important distinction between harm and diagnosis. It just doesn't necessarily mean that people weren't necessarily experiencing harm, but of course the question is how much of the harm can you attribute to gambling? But it brings up the issue that lottery sales are going up. It's possible that problem gambling isn't increasing. That may be just right there, just a full stop. But there could be other mental health problems going up as well, and maybe it's not necessarily problem gambling that is the bigger concern. So to answer your question with regards to the rise in lottery sales, I don't know that alone is a rise of concern. I would actually argue that the rise of concern for me from a mental health perspective isn't the rise of lottery sales as much as the rise of depression rates, suicidality ideation, and domestic violence, which the CDC and others have reported during this COVID-19 crisis.
Hmm. Devin Mills is an assistant professor of community, family, and addiction sciences at Texas Tech University. Professor Mills, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Friday, October 16th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Here's what's coming up next. We'll bring you the national news with USA Today next, and then at 3 o'clock, our local news. Here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Lee football coach wants to unify school through name change. MISD board opts to not go with committee's name recommendation. Prayer rally held for Bob Fu as protests continue. And from the Odessa American, doctors talk COVID-19 hospitalizations. Highway named after road champion. City unveils memorial for Odessan Ray C. Stoker Jr. And COVID-19 slide sparks concern. Those articles and more coming up in our two-hour local news broadcast that begins at 3. And then at 6, we'll bring you the Wall Street Journal. And as I always do on Fridays, I'm going to plug our 7 o'clock show. And that's called On the Lighter Side, with some humorous writings from some very, very funny writers. So after a week of bombardment with bad news, a great way to end the week. 7 o'clock On the Lighter Side. Also, as we do on Fridays, we're going to leave you with a song. It's been 3 years this month since we lost Tom Petty. Tom wrote and sang many, many songs that are tied to the soundtrack of our lives. So we're going to leave you with, I think, an appropriate song. This is Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down. We'll be back Monday at 1. Be well and have a great weekend. Well,